My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic.
Russell!
I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, nor have I taken a drink since January 25th, 1981, and I'm forever grateful for that gift. It is a gift, I believe, that I've been given, and for me to believe it's a gift helps me to continually be grateful to God for that gift. And somehow having an attitude of gratitude, no matter what's going on in my life, allows me to just have a better life. And so I prefer to have it that way. I've done life for the first 31 years ungrateful, and I've been doing life for quite a few years now grateful, and I prefer grateful. It's working out better for me. And, fortunately or unfortunately, I have found the way this thing works for me, and of course this is all my opinion based upon my experience. You know, it says our stories are important. That's what disclosed in a general way, what this deal's about, all about. I found out that part of the process of getting sober and realizing the promises and experiencing much of heaven and being rocking in the fourth dimension of existence, unfortunately for us, requires time. Things take time. Now, as an alcoholic, I have a lot of problems. You know, drinking, I learned years, I suppose, after coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I suppose I was told this, and I read this, and I suppose it was talked about in AA rooms. But, you know, it says when the pupil's ready, the teacher appears. You hear a lot of stuff, and you read a lot of stuff in AA, but sometimes you won't actually hear it and digest it until 10 years after you've come in the program. You sort of get stuff that you've been hearing all along, but you never. And one of the things that I've absolutely understand now, I certainly didn't understand when I first came in, when I thought my only problem was drinking, was that drinking was actually only a symptom of the disease. It wasn't even the disease. You know, I didn't even experience the disease of alcoholism in a sense, you know, when I was drinking, because all I experienced was drunk. And what I ultimately realized is that alcoholics drink alcohol so that they don't experience alcoholism. That alcoholism is something that happens to an alcoholic when he's not drinking. That men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They'll drink for the effect. Because sober, they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks they see others take with impunity. So I drank in order to chase away, numb, anesthetize the alcoholism. If I saw alcoholism 5 miles away, if I even knew what it was, I would say, I need a drink. And I wouldn't have to experience it. It wasn't until after I stopped drinking and I got sober that I got to experience what this disease is all about. And you start saying things like, now I know why I drank. You know, that kind of thing. And so this thing, the problem with our disease of alcoholism is it goes on and continues even after you stop drinking. Now, of course, when you first come in here, since they don't arrest you on the road for driving while greedy, and they don't arrest you for driving while feeling sorry for yourself, and they don't arrest you for driving while being frustrated, or driving while being lustful, or driving while being filled with self-pity, or driving while being angry, since they don't arrest you for that, they only arrest you for driving while drinking, and since you can actually hold down a job when you're angry, and hold down a job when you're frustrated, and hold down a job when you're lonely, and hold down a job when you're depressed, and it can interfere to a certain extent, when we come in here, because of all the debacles we've had because of alcoholism, we think that's the problem. And if we just stop drinking, everything's going to be wonderful, and we don't realize that we're drinking in order to mask the problem, the real problem. And so we come in here, and of course, once you give up the drinking, which by that time has taken over your life, took over my life, a myriad of problems go away, make you sort of believe, whether they call it the pink cloud or whatever it is, that everything is wonderful. You wake up in the morning, and you've got money on the dresser. You know, all of a sudden, people are patting you on the back in A and say, you look great, you feel great, you feel better. You know, a lot of the problems associated with booze go away. And then all of a sudden, 9 months rolls around, or 3 months rolls around, or 3 years rolls around and that committee starts and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you can't go to sleep and you got 15,000 voices in your mind. They're all talking bad crap about you and other people, and things happen and crises, and every day brings another problem and frustration and loneliness and boredom and despair and unhappiness and ups and down, and you're up and you're down and you're up and you're down and you're up and you're down, and that's like the first hour, you know. And you go to these discussion meetings and you're whining. So I essentially, when I first came to AA, I joined the initial fellowship in here, the fellowship of the thumb sucking crybabies, and you know, doing that deal. And and of course there are adults in here, but you want to stay away from them because they always say things that hurt your feelings and make you feel bad and stuff like that. So I want to talk a little bit about the steps, and we're going to talk a little bit about step 8 and 9 and what they mean to me. And there's certain things I want to cover, but there's one particular aspect I want to cover of 8 and 9, and I'll probably get to that later on, and that's the aspect of, the first aspect, the aspect of freedom, and the second aspect, which I think is very important, the aspect of self-esteem. What I found out about this disease and our old ideas, and our, you know, that what you find out is after you come in here is Bill Wilson said the next frontier is emotional sobriety, which somehow is linked with unhealthy dependencies. And if you think it takes years to figure out after you crash and burn that you have an alcohol problem and you're powerless over alcohol, you can't imagine how long it takes. Especially if you don't put yourself in the position of being rebuked by a sponsor who knows what he's doing, you'd be surprised at how long you can hold down a job and live your life and tell yourself that you're doing okay while you're constantly depressed and feeling sorry for yourself. Or while you're addicted to a man, or addicted to a woman, or addicted to a person, or addicted to a job, or addicted to pornography, addicted to any, you can be addicted to a slew of things that you don't even realize that you're addicted to, that's unhealthy for you, that's holding you back, that's causing you to make wrong decisions and feeling bad about yourself, and you don't even know it. If you think alcohol is hard to even get a grip on, you know, the first step of getting out of jail is you got to know you're in jail in the first place. You know, you'd be amazed at how, I mean, one of the things I say is I stopped drinking, or I came into Alcoholics Anonymous when the consequences of my drinking came at me faster than my ability to lower my standards. Because you can drink a lot and destroy your life, and somehow, while all the people are decimated and run away from you and you're all alone with a bottle of wine, somehow sit there and say, you know, I'm not doing so badly. Somehow rationalize, tell yourself rationalize that actually everything's okay. Well, you'd be surprised at how bad your life can get. How you can be living a life what do they call it? The life of, now I forgot. This is what happens when you get to be 62.
Quiet desperation.
Thank you very much. As the novelist says. And somehow, even after 5 years, 10 years, 15 years sobriety, you know, because in here we celebrate and you pick up the medallion, right? It's all about not drinking. You could be suicidal, paranoid, feeling sorry for yourself, sucking your thumb, having resentments all over the place. You got 15 years. You know, you don't drink and you don't die, and you got 15 years. We're giving you a medallion, and you can tell yourself that everything's wonderful. Just stay away from that parts about the big book where it talks about, you know, being rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence and experience much of heaven and stuff like that. You know, you just keep on saying, you know, progress, not perfection, or whatever it is that makes you feel like you're doing okay when you're really not. Just stay away from people that, you know, sort of like cause you to think about what's really going on. So one of the things that I understand in here, one of the things these steps are designed to do, and in some aspects, the fellowship is designed to do, and certainly a sponsor is designed to do, is put you involved in a fellowship and a system where over a period of time, a long period of time, as life beats the living crap out of you because you're just not getting it right, you use the 10th step spiritual axiom and the inventory, whenever I'm disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me, and become introspective over a long period of time, where you're constantly confronted with things that are challenges, that are hurting your feelings, that are bothering you, but instead of doing whenever you're disturbed, I used to do whenever I'm disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. And I can prove it mathematically. You know, and you know what they say in the big book? They say our alcoholic life seems the only normal life. So when you go through life feeling crappy about yourself and crappy about things and, you know, constantly being a victim and looking at how other people are messing up and they're not following directions and they're all screwed up and the whole world seems crazy to you and you're absolutely convinced, mathematically you can prove, even when you do things wrong, well, I wouldn't have done this wrong, my intention was good if it wasn't for you, when it's so clear that the problem is somebody else. You come into a group like this and all of a sudden they're trying to tell you you're the problem. When other people's defects are so glaring, you know, it's very, very difficult to sober when you're not drinking to switch your brain into that mode. To not look at that other person or that other situation or that bounce check or that situation and look at why do I feel bad? Why am I feeling sorry for myself? What is going on with me? It's very hard to do that. As a matter of fact, since we are defiant, that since that our chief characteristic is defiance, which means, don't tell me what to do. Even when we're confronted by somebody that loves us and cares about us and trying to help us and says, you know what your problem is? Our natural inclination is to say, why don't you just go screw yourself? Is to somehow put up the wall so that we're guaranteed never to get well. So we can just stay in our own brain, you know, in our own little box and never really see outside the box. And what I learned is over a period of time, if you don't get this thing, God has a marvelous way of disclosing it to you. You know, God had a marvelous way of disclosing to you. You had an out. Nobody came in here, you know, because they figured out intellectually that they have an alcohol problem. You know, like you're right. I guarantee you, even if you think you figured out you had an alcohol problem, it was somewhere on the heels of some unbelievable problem that was going on in your life. You know, he has a marvelous way of sort of engineering things in your life so that, you know, the cards all fall down and problems happen. And then we learn something about ourselves. And one of the things I understand about this disease now is it's so subtle. It's so subtle. I mean, drinking is not so subtle in the end, but our disease can be subtle. We can find ourselves blocked off from people. We can find ourselves alone. We can find ourselves feeling sorry for ourselves. We can find ourselves in all sorts of jams. You know, spending more money than, you know, listen, for many years, you know, I spent money I didn't have to buy things I didn't need to impress people I didn't like. You know, we can find ourselves in making so many bad decisions in so many areas, stuck in horrible relationships with terrible people that are unhealthy and not being able to leave and not understanding how, and you say, how the hell did I get here? How did I get here? And you don't even realize, you sort of realize that you volunteered for it. And you're choosing to be in the position you're in, but it doesn't seem like you're choosing to be in the position you're in because you feel powerless to get out of the position, almost like when before you came here you said, I can't envision a life without drinking. Well, I can't envision a life without... I can't envision a life without drinking. I can't envision a life without being with this guy. I can't envision a life without this gal. I can't envision a life without this job. I can't envision, you know, somehow hooked on to stuff that's dragging you down. I can't envision. I used to say to my sponsor, well, that's just my personality. He said, Russell, your personality's killing you. You know, and how do you even, to even get to the point where you see this stuff, and then once you see it, and it's in front of you, to accept it and understand that's what's going on, and then it's even harder to break it. You know, to even break, you know, I think probably a few months before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I realized I had a drinking problem. It sort of crossed my mind, I ought to stop drinking, or I'm drinking too much, or I have a drinking problem, but I couldn't do anything about it. And I think that's the way it works in here. We start realizing we have a problem with this, or realizing it becomes clear to us because it's causing pain in our lives, but we just can't see a way out because the disease is so subtle, and it's so strong, and it's so powerful. And there is one who has all power, and that one is God, but nobody wants to hear about that deal, you know what I mean? And, you know, because acceptance is the answer to all our problems, so, you know, apparently. And it's not. You know, I mean, it's probably the answer to a lot of problems, and certainly when I came in here, the idea of acceptance and accepting certain things I cannot change is important, but I had to ultimately get to the courage to change things I can. And I want to talk about, you know, this the eighth and ninth step, of course, has to do with personal relationships. That's what they say. But it's more than that. It's so much more than that. You know, I mean, you can go to the book and you can go to your sponsor. You know, look, I'm going to make this real fast as far as the how to do it. go to the book and go to your sponsor. The eighth step sort of comes out of the fourth step. You do the fourth step and you do the fifth step. You sort of clearly see what the harm is that you've done people. But there may be people, and there were people on my list, that I actually didn't show up on my four-step list because I didn't have a resentment against them, like my son, but I had harmed them. And it took a little while longer, but as I matured, I could see they belonged on the list, and I saw what I did wrong with my son, and then how to actually do the amends. Once you can see, it's not, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry may be part of it, but listen, if it's I'm sorry, you don't even need the book. If the eighth and ninth step is about I'm sorry, you don't need the book, you don't need a sponsor, you don't need anything, because I had a PhD in I'm sorry. Believe me, if you're an alcoholic and you don't have a PhD in I'm sorry, you're a different kind of, you suffer from a different kind of disease I suffer from. I was the king of I'm sorry. But when I said I'm sorry, I wasn't really sorry. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know what I was sorry for. When I said I'm sorry, what that meant is that's code for get off my back. You see, you know, I blew up your house and killed your wife and shot your dog. Hey, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And you got exactly, I don't know, I'll give you a minute or two to say that's okay, forget about it. But as soon as you don't say that's okay, I mean, of course, I'll brood about something for 10 years. The smallest slight I'll brood upon for 10 years. But once I say I'm sorry, the rules of the games are is you immediately forgive me because you better not make me feel bad or guilty. So I say I'm sorry, and then you don't immediately forgive me. And then I look at you and I says, what's the problem? I said I was sorry. I'm not sorry about anything. I just want to always feel okay and never feel bad for any of the consequences. And that's what booze did for me. I can't say booze made me hurt people or booze caused me to do something. I've hurt many people the same way after being sober, cold stone sober, as I did when I was drinking. The only thing booze did was allow me to live my sorry self and my conscience and continue to do it and be a bum about it. It just helped me to live my life feeling crappy about myself, not even knowing I felt crappy about myself, but just understanding I felt crappy. And the ninth step is basically, you know, I'll tell you what I never said. I never said words like I was wrong, because I never thought I was wrong. There's nobody I ever was angry at that didn't deserve my anger. There's nobody I ever hurt that didn't deserve being hurt. Every one of my actions were totally justified, and the people deserved it. You know, and even when I did something wrong, I wouldn't have done it wrong if it wasn't for you. So when you never think you're wrong, it's hard to make amends when you don't even know what you're making amends to, for. And you know, people know. Don't you know when somebody says they're sorry to you and they're insincere? Because they don't even know what they did. They're just saying, I'm sorry, it's just a throw. Well, I'm sorry. They're not even saying things like, I stole your money and that was wrong. Even then, I'm sorry. You know, what I appreciated things like this is, I should not have stole your money. That was wrong. I was dishonest. Here's it back again. You know what I mean? That's like a legitimate, you know, deal, something like that. But I'm not even going to go into the how-to. I wanted to get that out of the way because that's not really important to me right now. You'll get that from the next speaker or something. I want to talk about the benefits. I'm big on the benefits of why you do these things. Because I think when we come in here, and I know when I came in here, I did these things sort of like rogue because I was told to do them and I wanted to get through them and I wanted to be part of the fellowship and everything like that and all that stuff, and that's all good. But my feeling is, you know, it says if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. There's something, this is a program of attraction rather than promotion. And I think when you see where this thing is going to take you, you're going to want to do this deal. You're going to want to do this deal and how it plays into what's going on in your life. And maybe if I can get across anything, if as you're going through your life and things are happening to you, if you can recognize some stuff, and believe me, this has taken me many, many years. You know, but in January I'll have 31 years and I'm still working on 90% of this stuff. You know, I'm not cured yet myself or anything like that, but all of a sudden I start seeing patterns in other people and things going on in my own life where I see how this sort of thing plays it, how the eight and nine step and how it all plays into the promises. Right after the eight and nine steps, don't they, you know, they have the promise. You know what it says? You're going to know a new freedom. You don't even know what that is. You know why? Because it's new. You've never experienced before. A new happiness. You don't know what that is because you've never, it's different than the happiness you experienced before. No matter how far down, you're going to see where your experience... Listen, you're going to lose fear of people. You say, I wasn't scared of people. I used to drink all the time in bars. I said, well, if you weren't scared of people, why'd you have to drink to be around them? Why'd you have to drink to ask a girl to dance? Why'd you have to... If you weren't scared, why were you so anxious? Why did you have to drink when you were around and doing this stuff? Fear of people, fear of economic... All of a sudden it leaves you. How does this all play into that deal? And that's what I really want to talk about. It's funny how God does things. I was driving down here, and you see all of a sudden how the eighth and ninth step and the freedom plays into so many difficulties in life. And I got a call from a young lady, and you know, I'm not going to give you her name. You don't know who she is. You don't know what the circumstance. I guess her sponsor told me to call me or something, get my take on something. And I'm not going to tell you the actual story, but the bottom line is it had to do with a relationship that she was in that was like destroying her. You know, you perhaps as an alcoholic from time to time has found yourself in a relationship. Maybe it's a romantic relationship, sexual, whatever it is, with somebody else, you know, or maybe it's a job where it's just destroying you. It's destroying your life. You know, you're just thinking about it all the time. You're obsessed about it. It's just maybe it's something that's toxic, a toxic relationship, and you realized it's toxic immediately, and now you're on your eighth year or your ninth year of living in a toxic relationship. And it's a horrible relationship, and it's dragging you down, but here's the problem. And you know it's horrible, and your sponsor is sick of hearing about it, and your group is sick of hearing you talk about it, but here's your problem. And everybody, every time somebody says, you need to leave that, you need to put it aside, it's killing you, you say something like this: I know, but I can't. You might as well be drinking booze. I mean, I don't say that you might as well be drinking, but you are drinking the booze. You're drinking the booze, the Michael booze, or the Henrietta booze, or you're drinking, that's your booze. It's the same thing as drinking alcohol. You're drinking that person, and you can't put it down because you can't envision life without that. Well, what does that have to do with the eighth and ninth? It has everything to do with the eighth and ninth step. It has everything to do with the eighth and ninth step. Because you ultimately realize, you know, whenever you're disturbing what the problem is, there's something wrong with me, so you look and say, why can't I leave? Why can't I summon the courage to do that? What am I afraid of? What am I afraid of? I'm afraid of being alone. Why am I going to be alone? I'm going to be alone because nobody else will put up with me. Nobody else will speak. Why? Because I feel so crappy, because I'm such a piece of crap. Why do I feel like I'm such a piece of crap? You know, somebody with self-esteem, what's your self-esteem? Self-esteem is your reputation about yourself with yourself. You know, everybody has a reputation. Somebody, you know, you know people. You know, hey, what's so-and-so's reputation? He's an honest guy. He's an, you know, whatever. Your reputation with yourself, about yourself, is your self-esteem. Now, you can hide it, you can mask it, but you have a certain reputation with yourself that you think about yourself that you may hide from other people, but you, and if your reputation with yourself is that you're a piece of crap, you're going to find yourself in crappy relationships with crappy people and crappy situations, and you're not going to be able to leave because you want to know something? You don't believe you deserve any better. You just don't believe you don't believe you deserve any better. There's a reason why some women or some men can leave relationships and break off relationships, and some people stay stuck in them. And it all has to do, to a certain extent, with that deal. So what does 8 and 9 have to do with that? You know, what's that thing all about? And so I want to talk a little bit about the committee. I want to talk a little bit about the voices. Your conversation with yourself, about yourself. Well, you know, I don't know about you, but one of the things I found out about alcoholism is, you know, when I came in here, I thought I was, you know, I think one of the earmarks of an alcoholic, and maybe of regular people, I just don't talk to regular people that much. I talk to alcoholics a lot. Maybe it's the same thing with regular people. But one of the earmarks of alcoholics is they have a real strong sense that they're unique. In other words, like, nobody could possibly understand me because my problems are so unique. I'm so unique. I'm so different that nobody would understand me, you know, because you'd have to know exactly about everything. And so there's no use even talking about it because how can you help me? I'm different. And the longer I'm in here and the more stories I hear and the more I learn about myself, the more transparent I come to myself, I see about myself and I see other people, I realize that we're essentially twins. We're like nine. Sure, there's differences in height and weight and size and certain things and stuff like that. But essentially, you know, if I've thought of something, you've probably thought of it. You know, if I've had a thought, you've had that thought. I'm essentially, you know, I mean, that's why when people are honest at AA meetings and just tell what's on their mind in a transparent, people say, man, that was a great meeting. You know, I mean, that guy really spoke to me. Because the bottom line is we're more alike than we are different. You know, that's the deal with us. And one of the things that I find is that I have conversations with myself. You know, so of course, when we have conversations with ourselves, and there's a lot of ourselves, we call it the committee. You know, you ever hear people say, "I was at the committee." What do they mean? What do you mean when the has anybody seen heard in North Miami? They talk about the committee. I mean, that's the 10,000 people, the voices going on in your brain, and it's all about you and other people and everything, and it's coming at you real fast, and you want some. I'll tell you what's even worse than the committee. I think I might have spoken about this before. If I haven't, what's worse about than the committee? Because the good thing about the committee is at least you're invited to the meeting. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Never be concerned about the committee when you're invited to the meeting and you can listen in on what they're talking about. You understand what I'm saying? Because you can go to an AA meeting and you can tell everybody in AA what the committee's been talking about. You understand? Where you got to be careful and concerned about is the executive secret committee. Those are the guys inside of you that are meeting in secret, and you're not invited to the meeting. And they're there. You don't know they're there. They're there. And they're sending up messages. You get messages from them. You don't know you get messages from them. Sometimes you hear the messages. Sometimes you don't hear the messages. Sometimes they're very apparent. You'll be in the shower. You'll be lathering up, and you'll hear this. You're an asshole. Sure, you're laughing, Paul. You don't know what it's like. You're a jerk. You're never going to do well. You're always going to say, so you turn around and say, who's saying that? And you realize you're the only one driving the car. There ain't nobody there. Where are they coming from? Where are those messages coming from? Like Venus? Like a sunspot? It's coming from you. It's coming from the secret committee. They're sending it up. You know? Let's have them marry her. You know what I mean? You know? It's coming from the secret committee. These messages that we get about ourselves. And you want to know something? When you hear something like that, if you've ever heard this, you're an idiot. Anybody ever heard that? You're an idiot. Where does that come from? Where does that come from? You know what that is? That's you telling you about you. That's you telling you. That isn't your brother, your sister, your cousin who you can't stand, your mother, your father. That's you telling you about you. Now I'm going to tell you something even scarier. At least you heard that. Now, and it came from somewhere deep down inside of you where the secret committee. Now, let me tell you something. I'm going to suggest something to you. That when you don't hear that voice, that you're an idiot, it hasn't gone on vacation. Wherever that voice comes from telling you about you, that voice hasn't taken off to Milwaukee. It's still speaking to you. It's still inside of you. Even when you don't hear it, it's causing you to go out with this guy or this gal when you should be doing this. It's causing you to stay at this job when you should be at another job. It's causing you to make all sorts of decisions based upon fear because you're not worthy, because you're not worthwhile, because you're not good enough. How do you know you're not good enough? How do you know you're not worthwhile? Because you've told you about you. And you're continuing to tell you about you. And so you find yourself in horrible situations and with horrible people, you know, and you don't even know why you're there, but all you know is you can't leave because you're scared. And you don't even know why you're scared. So how do you get rid of that deal? And he says, we're selfish and self-centered. 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity. We step on the toes of others. We're a self-overrun riot, though we usually don't think so. The world and its people really dominate us in that sort of situation. People and the situations have the power to actually kill us. You know? Well, it tells us God has that power. God can help us with that. But how does the eighth and ninth step play into that deal? I was, I tell a little story. I don't know whether I've told it here before, but I guess it pretty much has to do with being illustrative of what I'm talking about. I was, and you know, I could tell a million stories like this, because we all have stories like this, but this is one of my favorite ones. I got divorced from my, first wife, and I had a beautiful son, just a wonderful boy. He's a great boy now, great kid. And he's doing very well, and we have a good relationship. And when I got divorced, I got visitation. And you know, maybe the visitation was on Saturday or Sunday. I can't remember exactly when it was. I think this particular time was on a Saturday morning, and I told him I was going to take him to the zoo. We had planned going to the zoo for about a week. And I had gone out with a guy named Sally the night before, because I was a bachelor now. Because I knew that was the answer to all my problems. I always knew that the answer to my problems was another woman. You know, if I could only find... believe me, I was on the hunt for her. She was going to fix me. I was going to find her. It was all about her. I was going to find her. And so I was on the hunt for that deal. And that's an addiction. That's an obsession. That's a strong... I've seen a lot of men. I've sponsored a lot of men in this program. I can't tell you how many have gone down the drain because they can't give up the obsession. The obsession, the addiction... that a woman will solve their problem, and it works just as strongly the other way with women. You know? And you know what happens when you get between an alcoholic and his addiction, and an alcoholic and his obsession? It's not like they say right away, oh, you're right, I got to break that deal. It's like, get out of my face. I'm not drinking, I'm not even thinking of drinking, I ain't giving this deal up. I don't even want to hear about this deal. You know, mind your own business. You know, it's very difficult to break these patterns in these deals. So in any event, I was going out with this gal named Sally. I'd gone out on that Friday night. And on Saturday morning, my son, I was supposed to pick him up at 10 o'clock, 10:30, and take him to the zoo. He had been waiting for a week. You know, Daddy, we're going to see you. Yeah, we're going to the zoo. And you know, like a true alcoholic fashion, I want you to know, I really did intend to take him to the zoo. Now, what you have to understand about that, if you're an alcoholic, we all know that if you're an alcoholic, if you actually intended in good faith to do something, the fact that you didn't do it doesn't mean anything, because you intended to put the check in the mail. You know what I mean? You intended. So I was, you know, the old saying, the world was judging me by my actions, I was judging myself by intention. But I intended to do it. Didn't matter whether I did it or not. And so what happened was, at around 9 o'clock that morning, I got a call from Sally. And she said, we're going out on the boat, myself and the girls. Would you like to come along? So now I was in a quandary. I had a decision I had to make. Now, I want you to know, I don't know how old I was. I have no idea, 27, 28 years old. I want to tell you, I was cold stone sober. I was as sober as I am tonight. Not emotionally or spiritually sober, but I'm talking about free of the booze. I can't blame the booze. And most of the selfish, self-centered decisions I made where I hurt people, I did it cold stone sober, just like I made this decision cold stone sober. And so here I have the decision. Sally, the girls, and the boat, and booze, or my son. Sally, the girls, the boat, the booze, or my son. It was a difficult decision. It must have taken me all of, I don't know, what, 15 seconds? Anchors away. Anchors away. You know, so now I got to call up my son. But, you know, that's sort of like a messy thing. And you know something, come to think of it, he wouldn't have that good a time with me anyway. He'll have a better time with his mother. Somehow, some way, I talked myself into believing that I didn't really have to call him up. And so I just took off, and I didn't even show up. I didn't even show up. Now I want to tell you something. It's interesting. I remember that story, and I tell that story as an example of something which I'm going to go into. But I'm absolutely sure, as I'm sitting here tonight, if I could remember them, I probably made thousands of decisions exactly as selfish as that one, with the same effect of hurting many people. I don't want anybody thinking here, well, that's the only selfish decision I made. That's the only time. I probably selfishly, soberly, made many decisions where I hurt and disappointed many people, telling them one thing and doing another thing and not showing up and being irresponsible probably happened many, many times. But that happens to be one I remember, which is the truth. It's part of my story. So I'm out there in the boat drinking and telling myself I'm a wonderful guy. There's nothing. I've already convinced, you know, after a few beers, I've absolutely convinced myself that I made the right decision and he's actually going to be happier without me there. I mean, I'm absolutely, I could prove it mathematically. And that's one great thing about being very smart, and we all know we're very smart. When you're really smart, you can be a really good lawyer and convince yourself all the bad things you're doing is perfectly okay. But, you know, deep down where my capacity to be honest lives, because apparently we have a capacity, deep down where that picture of Dorian Gray is, you know what I mean, and in the basement, there's where the secret committee is meeting, those guys in the committee, you know what they're saying. They're painting that picture. They're putting a mark on that picture and saying, you are some sort of piece of crap. You are some sort, because you know what I was? I was a bum. I may have had a lot of degrees. I may have had a three-piece suit. I may have been a lawyer, but I was a bum, because that's the way bums live their lives. You know, disappointing people, hurting people, ripping people's hearts out, being irresponsible, acting like idiots selfishly, not taking responsibility, not acting as an adult, and not caring about other people. And I was a bum. And I could have drank all I wanted and told myself how great I was, but deep down where that committee lives, you know, I was a bum, and nobody knows what a bum I was better than me. And I probably did that kind of deal many, many, many times. You know, when you got that stuff going inside of you, you can get sober all you want. You can stop drinking all you want, okay? That thing is deep down inside of you. It's there. That guilt. You know, when they talk about being restless, irritable, and discontented, unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, I guess the deal is, I guess what emotional sobriety is all about is one of the things is you want to make sure you're not restless, irritable, and discontented. And nothing will get you more restless, more irritable, more discontented than having people on your mind. I don't want to be living in a world where I'm worried about whether I'm going to run into somebody. You ever do that deal? You ever not go somewhere because he might be there? You ever not go somewhere because she might show up? You ever get a letter in the mail and you rip it out, you rip it and you throw it in the garbage before looking at it? You ever have the phone ring and you make sure you have, what do they call it, caller ID, because you want to know who's calling you up on the phone to decide whether or not you're going to answer it or not? What kind of life is that? I mean, I'm not putting anybody down, and I've probably done it before, and maybe there are legitimate reasons for not answering things, but imagine that kind of what that's about. Living a kind of life where you're avoiding people, scared to answer phones, ripping up letters, you know, scared to go to parties, scared to go to places, worried about when you wake up in the morning whether somebody's going to call you, what you're going to say, what you're going to do, you know what I mean? And walking into a store and seeing somebody and turning around and going the other way and saying in your mind, oh, I hope she didn't see me. What's that all about? That's the committee stuff. That's the secret committee. That's the stuff that's still, you know, it's very hard to live a life and have a relationship with God and be focused on him, and be focused on things that are good and right, when all you're doing is constantly thinking bad thoughts about yourself and other people. That's where the committee's coming from. You got to get rid of that stuff. I got to get rid of that stuff. You don't get a free pass on that. This ain't, you know, some people want cheap sobriety, cheap emotional sobriety. They stop drinking, now everything's okay, just like you say, the wind stopped, everything's okay, I should feel good forever. You know, and it doesn't, I'm sorry, it just doesn't work that way. And that's what the eighth and ninth step is all about. It's about finding about where you've caused harm, understanding, and then doing your best to clear it up. And what I found, and then, of course, the tenth step, which we'll talk about, I guess, next week, it has to do with continuing that and some other things that I'll talk about. And so one of the things that I found is that as I started to make amends, as I started to set right the things I'd done wrong and make the appropriate amends, all of a sudden, the voices start going away. All of a sudden, the voices start going away. And you know, when you start making amends and you start doing the right thing, not only do the voices start going away, and you start living by the principle of this program, but they're replaced by other voices. You'd be surprised the other voice. You get replaced by voices like, you know, you're a pretty good guy. You're not a bad guy. You're a good person. You're a decent person. You're trying to... They get replaced by voices telling you that you're a decent person, that you're okay, that you're doing the right thing. You know, I'm going to tell you something. Do you think if you have two people and you have one person who's telling himself he's an idiot and you have another person that's telling himself he's a decent guy, he's a decent person, do you think their decisions on different aspects of their life might be different as far as who they hang out with? You know, I'm telling you it does. It makes a big difference as to whether or not you can leave that relationship. You know, there are people that will get involved in relationships with other people. And it could be a relationship with another person. It could be a job. And you know, it'll get to a point where something will happen. They'll say, I don't deserve this. I'm not taking this. I'm out of here. You know what they do? You ready for this? They quit. They quit. They say, I'm out of here. I'm not going to do this. You know, I'm just not going to do this. You know, I deserve better. And there are other people that will take any amount of abuse you heap on them because they don't believe they deserve anything better in any situation. And that's all eighth and ninth. That's all self-esteem stuff. That's all about the eighth and ninth. That's all about that's the new freedom. That's what they're talking about when they say new freedom and the fear of people. And, you know, that's the new freedom and the new happiness to be able to sort of glide through life and make decisions without fear, and hang out with people or not hang out with people, and choose and be able to, and not find yourself trapped in situations where you're seemingly trapped there, saying, how did I get here? Alcoholics are constantly finding themselves in situations where they go up to their sponsor, they're saying, I don't know how this happened. And the sponsor tries to explain to them, because you signed the contract, because you took the job. Because you went, because you're there because you decided to go there. Because you went to the party. That's why you're there. You gotta leave. Well, I can't leave. Well, that's because you have decided that you can't leave. You're the one who's making your own. Now, I'm not saying we don't get involved in situations that's not our fault, and that happens from time to time. But many an alcoholic, cold stone sober, finds themselves in situations that seem absolutely impossible, where they put themselves in the situation in the first place, and they can't even, and even when their sponsor or somebody in AA shows them the door on how to get out, they say, I can't do that. We drive people crazy. We drive them into Al-Anon. You'd be surprised how many people are in Al-Anon today because they can't understand alcoholics. We just drive them crazy. You know, the typical alcoholic, by the way, if you ever sponsor people, you know, I'll talk about this in the 12th step. I basically assume that whenever I sponsor somebody, that they're basically out to get me drunk. You know, because they are. They're, you know, I mean, any sponsor-sponsee relationship, you have to understand basically what a sponsor wants to do, whether he knows it or not, is get his sponsor drunk. You know, as long as you understand this guy is trying to get me drunk, and one of us may drink, but it ain't going to be me, you're going to be okay. Because this is what they do. They bring you an impossible situation. They say, I'm going out with this heroin addict who tried to stab me with a knife the other day, and she says she's going to kill me, and I don't know what to do. So as the sponsor, you say, this is what you say. By the way, this scenario actually happened to me. You say, listen to me, this is what I want you to do. You say, what? He says, leave. Leave, Kevin. When the woman starts coming at you with scissors, that's God's way of saying, it's time to leave. And then Kevin says to you, I can't. And that's when you drink or you don't drink or you go nuts or you go crazy. He says, what do you mean you can't? And then he starts talking and then you're lost because you're actually listening to him. You know, it's like The Exorcist. You know, the guy said The Exorcist says, whatever you do, don't get into a conversation with it. Don't listen to it, because he starts explaining why he can't leave. Because he feels guilty and everything like that, and what's she going to do, and what if she commits suicide, and you start being drawn into the web. And all of a sudden, it's sort of making all sense to you, because you're an alcoholic too, he's playing with too, and you're not saying, yeah, he can't leave. And so you try to think of a different way of doing it, and you say, okay, don't leave, why don't you do this? And you think of a different thing, maybe you think of a different thing, and then he says, and you think of a different thing. Okay, get her counseling or something like that and going for counseling. He says, we can't do that. And, you know, unless you know what's going on and what the story is, you know, the next thing you know, you're going crazy. And you're going nuts. And you're calling up your sponsor and saying, what do I do? You know? I mean, that's the way you've been there. You know that's what happens in here. That's what happens in this deal. And it's all about working these steps, doing things we have to do in order to clear up that self-esteem, clear up that guilt that we have, so we can have that new freedom and and we don't get trapped in those situations. And it may take years. It takes time to do this stuff, you know, but there's an incredible benefit. That's why it says, after we do this stuff, what comes after we do this stuff? And we start getting our self-esteem back on our reputation. What happened? That's when the promises happen. That's when the new freedom happens. That's when the new happiness happens. That's when the fear of people disappears. That's when we stop walking along the street worrying about who we're going to run into. That's when we go to sleep at night and we stop thinking about how many people have a hard time thinking, hard time sleeping. You ever have a hard time going to sleep because you're thinking about a situation or a person and you can't get it out of your mind? And you say, I got to stop thinking about this, and you can't? You wake up in the morning, you're still thinking about it. It's driving you crazy, and you know it's not alcohol, it's alcoholism. It's all about those people that are on your mind, living rent-free in your head because of guilt, because of something you did, and you can't seem to get out of it, and you don't know what the answer is, and you can't talk to anybody because they wouldn't understand, because it's unique, and you're so unique, and you got such a big problem. That's alcoholism. That's why we drank, because when you drink, it makes it go away. And you feel good for a nanosecond. You know, the drinking is not the alcoholism. It's the thing that happens before the drink, which is the alcoholism, which causes you to drink. And that's what these steps are designed to get rid of, so that you're not restless, irritable, and discontent and feeling guilty. And you don't have to drink. There's no need to drink, because it never gets that bad. It just never gets that bad. So thank you very much. Next week we'll talk about...